I'll just recognize people who want to make comments or ask questions. Let's go to the middle of the back and then to the back corner. Yes. Yes, you.
Two related themes. Firstly, I fail to understand why you address the issue of peak oil when we certainly understand that the last thing we need to do is to burn the fossil fuels, particularly oil, that we've already found. Particularly when one bears in mind the discussion at the end of your presentation on the whole issue of the accumulating concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Related to that is my more pertinent question in some ways, which is your proposition that the way of tackling this is through the pricing mechanism. The pricing mechanism has attached to it inequitable outcomes, as you know, and therefore I would be most interested, as I would hope this audience would be interested, in knowing what objections you have just to the principle of equal per capita rationing of carbon emissions based on the Global Commons Institute's global strategy of contraction and convergence.
Okay, both. So I think what we need to do is accept that a significant portion of the remaining hydrocarbons in the planet will be burned, and try to figure out how we can cope with the consequences of that. Either by well, oil is marvelous stuff. It packs an enormous energy punch. It's got wonderful properties, so it's going to be one of the first things we extract from the ground and use.
But your concern was that we were going to run out of oil.
Well, we've been running out since the day we drilled the first well. I think that's irrelevant. But the concern, if you remember in my presentation, is that we're now into a world where the energy cost of extracting petroleum is rising very fast, and that's driving a shift, in particular, to more carbon-intensive forms of energy, such as coal. That's my concern. We want to be going in the other direction, decarbonization, but we've started to recarbonize. If we had enough oil to use it instead of coal while we go through this transition to zero carbon, that would be a good thing. But unfortunately, we're now in a situation of very rapidly declining energy return on investment for oil, and we're being driven towards exactly the fuel we don't want to use, which is coal. So that's why part of the package, the suite of solutions here, has to be CCS, carbon capture and storage. If people are going to use coal, we've got to keep the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
Hello?
Good.
So if people are going to use coal, we've got to keep carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. I don't like this. I think this is a mess. But I'm trying to figure out what is a plausible escape route from this challenge we've gotten ourselves into in a world of peak oil, or what I think is ultimately more significant, rapidly dropping energy return on investment for oil. Now, the rationing versus market approaches to dealing with this. You're absolutely right that there are enormous inequities in our market systems. Most of the proposals for carbon pricing that are out there involve some kind of progressive transfer of the revenues generated, especially if we're talking about a tax. This is, for instance, a case in British Columbia, the first carbon tax introduced in North America. Involve proposals for progressive transfer of the resources accumulated from that carbon tax to people who will be affected more severely, poorer segments, socioeconomic groups in the society. And that was also true of the proposal put forward by the Liberal Party in the last federal election in Canada. Those are the two proposals I'm most familiar with. In general, I am not a fan of rationing. Because I think that you want to let distributed innovation take place within a market system. I think ultimately that provides you much faster adaptation. And you deal with the welfare implications of the operation of the market by resource transfers mandated by the state.
Such as progressive taxation. That's a larger almost philosophical discussion that influences policy prescriptions, and we can have that discussion separately, but I'm just giving you my bias. Markets are one of the most extraordinary distributed problem-solving systems that humankind have ever developed. I want to unleash the entrepreneurship of markets to get them focused on this problem. And then you have other mechanisms for dealing with the distributive consequences. Yes, in the back corner.
I've just finished your recent book, Carbon Shift. And in the conclusion of that, if you go a little further than you have today, I quote you, voluntarily or not, growth is going to define is going to stop in this century. We'll all be a lot better off in the process if the process is voluntary. If business as usual simply cannot continue, we better start thinking hard about what our next step of business is.
You're absolutely right. Well, it's right at the bottom there, and I sort of ran out of time. And it's kind of it's a big issue, but it relates directly to the previous question. So let me talk about it. I have, at the bottom, the most radical is not a technological proposal. It's shifting away from conventionally defined growth. So the World Bank, in its 2006 report, which is the last one I looked at, suggested that we would have growth in real terms through this century of 2.5 to 3% a year for the global economy. That gives us a doubling time of 25 years or so. It means, again, by the time my children are my age, that we'll go from a 70 trillion world economy to a 300 trillion world economy. And that's in today's dollars. And even with extraordinary advances in efficiency, it's going to be very hard not during that period of time to double the throughput of energy and material in the global economy. And we're already wrecking the global ecosystem with a 70 trillion world economy. If we double the material and energy throughput in the next 50 years, this is not going to happen. There is a disconnect here. There's a kind of insanity in our policy. I mean, if individuals were behaving this way, we would declare them mentally handicapped, right? One part of the brain is thinking one thing, and the other part of the brain is recognizing something else, and the gap is widening. And we're living in this world. Well, we're pretending it's this world, but we're actually living in this world. And sooner or later, that disconnect will disappear because the fantasy world won't be possible anymore. To put that in the terms that you quoted in the book, sometime this century, global economic growth will stop. Well, it has stopped, but, you know, let's talk about that for a moment because it's a very good point. Why are we hooked on growth? Even in wealthy countries where it's well established, it doesn't make us happier anymore, psychologically. That's a very interesting question. Well, I think it's because we've internalized these three equivalencies. Growth equals solvency, growth equals freedom, growth equals peace. And I think there's some validity to all three of these. First, we tend to grow out of our debts. We want to grow out of our debts by expanding our household incomes or our national incomes. It's going to be a key policy proposal in dealing with the debt accumulated to deal with this economic crisis. We have to get growth up so that we can lower the proportion of national indebtedness to the size of the national economy. That's the way Western economies dealt with their debts after the Second World War. It's how we deal with our pension crisis, expand the size of the economy. I believe that we've internalized the notion that we need economic growth for personal freedom. And I think that actually goes back, I had a PhD student who traced this all the way back to through the Enlightenment, back to the Renaissance, and the development of notions of progress in Western society. But I think the most fundamental equivalency is this notion of growth equaling peace. And this is a lesson that we learned in the 1930s. Why is it that policymakers around the world are terrified of this economic crisis? Because in the 1930s, we had a demand collapse, and a consumption collapse, a rapid rise in unemployment, the radicalization of many societies, the development of national socialism, the Second World War, and the Holocaust. And there's very strong causal links between all of those phenomena. And John Maynard Keynes came along and proposed a series of solutions to sustain consumption and perpetuate growth that would allow economies to absorb any surplus labor that was disemployed as a result of increasing labor productivity and technological change.
On an annual basis, and this is an argument I make in my last book, The Upside Down, the standard Western economy needs 2, 3, 4% real growth a year to absorb labor that is disemployed because of the natural process of increasing labor productivity and technological change. I mean, this is a point that Marx made a long time ago. But it's something that, no matter how much we want to deny it, it happens to be a fact of capitalist economies that they are extremely good at producing too much stuff for the amount of demand in the economy. And what happens over time is that that pool of disemployed labor becomes potentially radicalizable, and it also undermines consumption and demand in the economy. So it's actually a fundamental contradiction in the economic system. Keynes came along and provided tools to make sure that didn't happen anymore. As John Kenneth Galbraith, the late American economist, said, growth is the best lubricant for friction between rich and poor. It prevents a zero-sum competition, knock-down, drag-out competition between rich and poor. Now this gets to the issue that you raised, because the really deep issue here is inequality. How are we going to maintain political and social stability on a planet where 40-45% of the world's population still makes $2 a day or less if we have a steady-state global economy? Who's going to pay the price for that? Now, this is a question I don't have a clear answer to, but I think it's one of the central ones we need to be investigating. I'd like to keep a role for markets, maybe even some modified version of capitalism, but the problem is this is a question that we're not even asking. We're addicted to growth, we use it to maintain social peace, we're terrified if we don't have it. As soon as we have a collapse in growth, everybody wants to, we're all watching the rise of political extremism in Eastern Europe. We're all watching what's happening in countries like Pakistan from the economic crisis. This could be really bad news for the world. We don't have an alternative economic model that will address these three problems, which are real problems. If you want to see a very good treatment of the middle one, growth equaling freedom, read Benjamin Friedman's book, The Moral Argument for Economic Growth, that came out about 3 years ago. He's a senior economist at Harvard. And I don't want to trivialize this. We will move to the steady state global economy. We need to do it voluntarily. How we're going to do it, I haven't got a clue. There are people out there like Herman Daly who've given a great deal of thought to the technicalities of the steady state economy. But the real problems are social and ethical and political. How are we going to maintain peace in our societies if they aren't growing? So I can leave that one with you. But I hope that answers your question. And it was great that I had a chance to show this slide. Yes?
Hi, I'm Mark Hamill from the Center for Transit Technology. I really enjoyed your talk. It was fantastic. And I think it's a great example of obviously everyone's very shocked by now the job that's in front of us. What you're saying about we don't have any solutions for this, I don't know if you caught, you won't have seen Newsnight a couple of months ago, but Mohammed Yunus, the Nobel Peace Prize winner for Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, actually had Gavin Esser laughing for the first time in months since the crisis had started. And Gavin Esser saying, you mean there actually is an answer to our economic problems at the moment? And this is about basically microfinance systems that offer very small sums of money at very low rates of interest, and the interest is plowed back into the social ethical reinvestment of that funding stream.
Yep.
And so I think you're right, we don't have the answers, but I think the core principle that we've got to discover now is how we learn with humility from other countries.
Experiment.
They have been dealing with these problems for years because they have been facing climate change and problems with development and problems with poverty for years, and they are finding really, really useful, intrinsically helpful systems. And that microfinance is now spreading obviously around the world. I'm sure you know far more about it than I do, but I think that's an answer that you can offer people. I think people also want to know what we should be doing.
Yeah, and I should say, we go back to this set, just on your last one. I'm one of these people who believes that you add up all the little things and they actually become a big thing over time. And, if each household is making some changes and you do that across tens of millions of households, it becomes real carbon. And I regard this political and social process as a ground war at the time being. For the time being, it's one meeting like this, one conversation, one buttonholing of an MP, one letter to the editor at a time. one activity within a local community group or an NGO at a time. It might not look like much is happening for a long period of time, and then all of a sudden you get this social phenomenon, like a sudden social shift, because social events are very non-linear. Who would have expected that apartheid would end without violence? Who anticipated really the end of the Soviet bloc? Who would have expected that Barack Obama would be elected president of the United States? And this, these are tipping point social phenomena that are often a product of lots of work, little bits of work by people at the local level accumulating over time and producing the critical mass. So I wanted to just say that about small events, but small activities, because they're very important. We can all do something. We shouldn't forget that. On the issue of microfinance, I think microfinance has produced remarkable results in many places. There are scale-up issues, especially when you need large quantities of capital to build big infrastructure and things like that. I mean, the lesson here is that any set of solutions is going to be mapped onto the context. There are some things that are going to work in some places and not in others. There's another economic or financial model, the cooperative model, that actually can provide accumulations of capital it's not dissimilar in some respects to the microfinance model, but it's something that we use a lot in North America, and you have lots of co-ops here, I imagine. Banking co-ops, housing co-ops, agricultural co-ops, and some of them are very large and accumulate very large pools of capital. Generally, they've been affected less by the economic crisis because they've had less, more conservative investment policies. And there's a social and democratic, and I don't necessarily need to link those two words, ethos to the cooperative movement. And a non-profit ethos that produces very different outcomes economically. And there may not be such an incentive for growth in that kind of economic system. So one thing I'm doing right now is I'm learning a lot more about the cooperative movement, which interestingly enough started in Canada. It was one of the initial places where it began, in the prairies, in Saskatchewan, during the Great Depression, where in Canada we have a horrific environment, especially in the prairies, especially in the winter. And communities had learned that they had to pull together to make a go of it. And when the Depression came along, they developed a whole economic model for addressing the challenges they were facing, and it's now propagated all over the place. There are things that we can learn from a lot of different places in addressing these challenges, but I don't think the larger story is worked out yet. Yes?
Yeah, well, I'm glad, Thomas, you mentioned, as it were, in the last few things you said about the social issues, because it seems to me the social issues are really where we need to start. I mean, the technological solutions and the economic solutions, I mean, these are all byproducts of a social problem. And so it's a social where we see where we need to begin, and we're doing something lovely. Now, one social issue which you very rarely mentioned is this question. You spoke about population as though it's simply going to go on. You know, to anything about it, we have to accept it as given. And I think we need to challenge that particular point of view. The other thing I think is important is in relation to education. Not the kind of thing that currently goes on in schools, but education which is prepares us for the world that is to come. So that each of us knows as an individual and as a group and as a family how to survive in the future. And you see, this is where we need to be working. I agree we need the technological and economic solutions, but this is only part of the story.
Well, you're absolutely right. And let me say just something quickly about population. And population is one of the ultimate driving factors of variables here. There's no question about it. However, it's one of the few success stories in a way, because we brought down fertility rates much faster in many countries than we were expecting. A lot of people back in the 1960s and 70s were expecting a peak global population of 11, 12, 13 billion people. And now we're looking at probably 9 at the outside. Now, that's not great, but it's a lot better than where we thought we were going. We've seen extraordinary declines in countries that have intractably high fertility rates, such as Kenya, Bangladesh, even in places where there hasn't been a lot of economic growth, but because of better education of women, because of different economic opportunities for women, the availability of contraceptives, fertility rates have gone down. Nonetheless, to agree with you completely, somewhere around 20% of all the births in the world are unwanted. which means that's an easy target. There's a new report that's come out from just come out from Population Action International in Washington, D.C. that says one of the first things that we can do on climate change is deal with aggressive action on these unwanted births. And if people don't want them, and if it's a matter of getting contraceptives out there and probably perhaps removing at least 10% of that 20% right off the top, that could make a real difference. I agree. The second point was
education.
Right. Well, in my title, I talked about resilience. And resilient people, institutions, and societies have this capability to withstand shock without catastrophic failure, which is exactly what you're talking about. And in my last book, I talk a lot about what we need to achieve, what I call a prospective mind, which is a mental stance to a rapidly changing world that allows us to cope effectively. It's a mental stance of not being surprised by surprise, recognizing
that. Leave it in the comments.
Yeah, that's.
I think that's
for me.
Isn't the bell supposed to ring?
This means I've got to go and wander through rooms, which is why Alan just ran off. If I could say thank you for speaking here, I know you're going to continue. Normally we try and finish about 8, so.
Okay. 5 minutes.
I'm not going to be here, so apologies for that.
Thank you very much.
The prospective mind is a mental stance that allows you to see shock and change and crisis as an opportunity, not just as an obstacle and something that you should be scared of. And I talk about these various things that we have to do in shifting to that perspective, or changing our understanding of systems from mechanical to complex. I've talked about that. This could all be part of the educational change. I've talked about this to educators. Shifting our understanding of ourselves from consumers to problem solvers. I mean, the dominant notion of human beings in our modern economies is human beings as walking appetites that sustain growth in our economies. That doesn't help us have much confidence in ourselves to address these problems. In fact, it gets us to do things that actually make the problems worse. Changes in our values from utilitarian to moral and existential. This is a point, I'll just elaborate on this very, very briefly. Utilitarian values are simple likes and dislikes. I like chocolate ice cream more than vanilla ice cream. The kind of values that economists would normally talk about. Moral obviously relate to issues of fairness and justice between us across time and space. And existential values are ones that are very rarely discussed. They relate to our notions of the good life, what brings meaning into our lives, what our relationship with the cosmos is. Questions usually beginning with why that we ask until we're about 10 years old, and then because of the looks on adults' faces, stop asking them. And we're told to go to a religious institution to ask those questions. But we walk in the door of our local mosque or synagogue or church, and we're not given a place to think about them unless you go into a Unitarian church. And instead, we're given a creed. We're told what to think. And in the absence of a conversation in our societies about these things, like what the good life is, utilitarian values fill up the space. So we go to the mall to deal with our existential angst. And that actually is not, I'm not joking, that's how we fill up this gap in our sense of self and our purpose in our lives. This, I think, is a fundamental educational project. But it's not just for our kids, it's for all of us, right? And then in terms of knowledge, this relates to the issue of not siloing our knowledge. One of the reasons I moved to the University of Waterloo, which, very quick plug, is the most interesting intellectual and academic environment in Canada now by far, is because it's a powerhouse on interdisciplinary work. It's just extraordinary the way people move across boundaries. It's like MIT, which is where I did my graduate work, which is also highly interdisciplinary. We need to encourage that kind of educational environment. And then finally, our notions of community have to shift from narrow national, ethnic, and cultural notions to global notions. I think that's more generally understood, although not acted upon. The starting point, in many ways, is an educational project. Problem is, that stuff takes time. And the technology is something that we also have to do in the meantime. I think we have to sort of fire on all guns simultaneously here. Let's go to the back.
First of all, can I just say the transition is doing exactly what you described,
yep.
Yep. Something I believe in very strongly.
Yes.
And secondly, you were saying small groups of people now have the ability to kill large numbers of people. Small groups of people also have the power to do good because of the technologies via the internet. And by the way, that's going on. The question I wanted to ask is quite different. It's about war. Wars in the past have been really based either on religion or power or land. And do you feel, as I do, that perhaps water or food may well provoke war, not necessarily war between nations, but civil war as well?
Okay. Let's just quickly on the transition town movement. Absolutely. But I understand that it's really a very active movement in the UK. It's something that's beginning to make inroads in North America. It's very interesting. I don't know a huge amount about it, but I get the sense that there's a lot. It's talking about community resilience. It's talking about building up inventories of buffering capacity, trying to cope and take advantage of crisis, cope with and take advantage of crisis. The second issue you mentioned was... No, but that was the war.
Oh, making good use of technology.
Yes, the power shift issue. That in my comments about power shift, the power shift, were when I elaborate on it, I say that all kinds of power has gone down the social hierarchy to small groups. Power that can be used for good, obviously, and is in many ways around the world, where the whole is much more than the sum of the parts. Where you're getting groups of people together that are much smarter collectively and solving problems than they would be as individuals. But power has also, unfortunately, shifted down the hierarchy, the power to destroy. And I'm very concerned about some of these groups getting weapons of mass destruction. I think the simultaneous explosion of two highly enriched uranium devices in London and downtown Manhattan would, if one went off in the city here, it could quite possibly eliminate about a quarter of global GDP instantaneously. We have built up enormously vulnerable systems, and there's a great deal of leverage now of small groups. This is why, by the way, Pakistan has to be on our radar screens, because they've got 60 to 100 weapons that are fueled by highly enriched uranium, and it's easy to make a bomb out of that stuff if it gets into the wrong hands. So that's just an aside. In terms of war, it actually relates. Food and water, I don't think we're going to see, the short answer is I don't think we're going to see conventional conflicts between countries over food and water. We haven't seen much conflict between countries over water in the past. Normally water scarcity, for instance, in a river basin stimulates cooperation, not conflict. There's lots of research showing that. But where I think you're absolutely right, and where my research has pointed in the past, is that food and water scarcity erode economic well-being, social capital, institutional capacity within societies, and can be not proximate but sort of hidden causes of insurgency, civil violence, even revolutionary movements over time. So these environmental stresses contribute to the overloading of institutions and coping capacity that I talked about at the beginning of my presentation, and contribute to distributed conflict within societies. Exactly the kind of conflict, actually, that our conventional responses have a lot of trouble dealing with, right? Guerrilla wars, insurgencies, that kind of thing. The kind of unmanageable stuff that seems to be happening right now with the Taliban in Pakistan, in the Swat Valley, and now approaching Islamabad. If you read the stories on that, the Taliban have figured out how to mobilize the poorest of the poor, the people who have been suffering the most from a highly exploitative feudal system, where local resources are often highly degraded, and where people just have not been able to prosper. Now, environmental stresses, including climate change, will make those problems a lot worse. So people will see as a proximate cause of these conflicts political radicalization, Islamic radicalization or fanaticism or something, but the deeper causes often will be material. And they, unfortunately, will frequently not be recognized. But that's the story you need to tell. Not wars between countries, but a lot of internal conflict that may have large-scale geopolitical consequences. If Pakistan falls apart, it's going to be a big story for the world. We'll take say two more quickly over here, and then I'll be.
Thank you, Professor, for your very enlightening talk. You seem to have focused primarily on climate change, with supporting roles played by peak oil, then population growth, and then other things such as environmental degradation. Climate change, isn't that perhaps the biggest problem, but the most immediate problem is peak oil, since that is what's caused the recent economic collapse. The big problem, as I see it, is that we have dysfunctional governments who are failing to recognise it and still living in the past with policies trying to reinflate this failed old economy of debt and an oil-based economy. How can we influence these dysfunctional governments to stop doing ridiculous things like mortgaging the future of everyone in their country? To prop up failed banks, failed auto industry, next it'll be failed auto airlines, when they should be investing in these things you've mentioned, such as geothermal, renewable energy, and small-scale community-based economies.
Well, answering that question would take the rest of the evening, and I certainly don't have a complete answer. One point that I would make is that these policy approaches that want to return us to the status quo ante, and that emphasize centralized solutions and capital-intensive solutions like nuclear, hydro dams, or whatever, are more readily adopted because there are powerful economic vested interests in our societies that that benefit from those policies. Capital-intensive solutions to our energy problems, such as nuclear power or big coal-fired power plants, they preferentially mobilize very focused economic interests. Distributed solutions, while perhaps preferable from a policy point of view, at least in some circumstances, tend to produce atomized political responses because they're distributed. You've got very focused political action, lobbying in the corridors of power by the cement firms and the steel firms and the nuclear engineering firms all saying, we want this plant and we'll put some money in your re-election coffers if you do it. Whereas the people out there are saying we'd like a couple of solar panels on our roof and maybe a wind generator for our little community, they don't have access because they don't have the resources and the money. This is a fundamental disadvantage of most renewable solutions to our energy problem. They're distributed, and their political power is distributed or diffuse also, whereas capital-intensive ones have concentrated political power. That's an analysis. It's not a solution. It means that we've got a political problem of mobilization, of organizing, to get political action focused and get into those corridors of power, too. The issue of peak oil versus climate change. The book that the gentleman at the back quoted from has just come out in Canada. It's available on Amazon if you want to get it here. It's for a Canadian audience, but I'd say 80-90%. The gentleman in the back can say what his opinion is, but 80-90% is actually information that would be useful anywhere in the world. It actually has at its core a debate over whether climate change or peak oil is more important. As editors of the book, Nick Arison and I decided that we weren't going to engage in that debate because instead we saw this very close link that I elaborated here, that peak oil is driving us to energy sources that are actually doing a lot more damage on climate. Which is going to hit us first? In some ways, in terms of our, you know, in our pocketbooks, or in terms of social disruption and economic disruption, is debatable. And you can see the debate right in there among very smart people. I do agree, though, that this recent economic crisis, the proximate cause in many respects, not the whole cause, but the proximate cause was this rapid ice in energy crisis. And if you want to see a really good analysis of that, the Brookings Institute in Washington just came out with a major paper 2-3 weeks ago. It's on my website, if anybody's interested, homerdixon.com, Homer Dixon without a hyphen. It's at the bottom of the website. And it does the analysis of crunches and numbers and shows that the American recession was caused, the proximate cause of the American recession is a run-up in oil prices. The deeper causes were some of those issues I was talking about earlier, building up of an edifice, an unsustainable edifice of debt on the assumption that we could manage the risk effectively. So energy, in some, you would say, is having some immediate impacts already. I happen to be of the opinion, not some of the people in that book, but I happen to be of the opinion that when the global economy recovers, it's going to very rapidly run into a supply ceiling and again rapidly rising prices. So we're going to, as I said in one of the papers, in one of the slides there, get a reshuffling of the relative price of energy to other things in our basket of goods and services. It's going to become steadily more expensive relative to other things, and that's going to put an enormous burden on people. Just the last point I'd make about this is if that cost is in the present, the climate change cost could be vastly larger, but it's out into the future. It's a wicked problem, what specialists call a wicked problem, because there's enormous incentive to delay and deny because it's sort of uncertain and it's way out in the future. And I, you know, ultimately, when I look at my kids, I'm not sure whether one is more important than the other. I think they're both really nasty, and they're both related to each other. Let's take this as the last one.
Thanks. A few years ago, an interdisciplinary team at UC Berkeley also wrote a short paper looking at peak oil versus climate change, and they made the same points you did. Around the time that was happening, as far as I can tell, the IPCC was asking the International Energy Agency for their projection on fossil fuel use.
Oh, yes.
And they were basically saying that peak oil didn't exist.
Well, they changed their mind.
Sorry?
They've changed their mind.
They have indeed. And I'm wondering whether that's part of the reason why the climate scientists were so surprised right then. And secondly, whether this realization about peak oil is factored into the climate change negotiations that are happening now.
Not really. Not a lot of people, in my experience, are making this point. That the rising energetic cost of oil is driving the shift to coal. Now, there are two things that are driving this rapid rise in carbon emissions. One is the shift to coal, the recarbonization of our energy economies, and the second is just the rapid growth in the world economy, rapid energy intensification in India and China in particular. A lot of people are paying attention to the latter and less attention to the former. In fact, there's still some people like Jesse Ossabell at Rockefeller University who are arguing that the long-term trend for the human energy system is decarbonization. Well, I think the evidence now is pretty clear that that's not the case. So the peak oil debate is not figuring significantly in the IPCC process. And I think a lot of climate scientists are taking the position of David Keith and Mark Jacquard do in this book, is basically say this is a secondary issue. The really big one is climate change. Because they believe that, and Mark Jacquard makes the argument beautifully in this book, he's a leading Canadian energy economist, they believe that markets will produce price changes when oil prices go up sharply that will stimulate substitution, and there's so much coal available that we'll just start, we'll start gasifying and liquefying coal, and we'll use that as our transportation fuel. And we can roll out those plants because it was done in Germany in the Second World War, it was done in South Africa, the Chinese are doing them now already, they're building a lot of liquefaction plants. And so that's the obvious solution, which has horrible climate implications. But ultimately, peak oil is not so much a problem. David Keith does a very nice job in his first paper. He says, you know, let's look at the two scenarios. A world where there's peak oil and no climate problem, and a world where there's a climate problem and no peak oil problem. Which of those worlds is worse and harder, presents a harder policy problem? And he says it's the latter, not the former. Because for the former, we have a solution, and it's coal. I don't think it's so easy. But that's the kind of debate. Now, there's one other debate here that's really important, just to finish off the evening, and that is whether there's actually enough hydrocarbon in the ground, even if we've burnt it all, to keep pushing up carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere to triple, quadruple, quintuple. And David Hughes, who's a leading Canadian resource geologist, who's just quit our national resource federal ministry, NRCan, Natural Resources Canada, and who is very familiar with not only the Canadian resource statistics, but world resource for coal, oil, and natural gas, thinks that actually, and he's in a minority on this, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's wrong. He thinks we're going to run out of hydrocarbons before we drive concentrations much above 500. So all I can say is that these debates are out there. It doesn't really provide a satisfying answer to you, because, you know, some people will say peak oil is the most important, some people will say climate change is the most important. But I just think we're in kind of a stew, and we probably would be best to address both of them. And it turns out, and that's why the book is titled Carbon Shift, it turns out that the answer is actually dealing with carbon. Because if we deal with carbon, to get a price on carbon, we not only reduce the emissions of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but we start driving the economy away from all hydrocarbons, including oil, which is where we want to go. So if we focus on carbon, it becomes the clarifying concept. Okay, thank you very much.